Monday evening, Dunked On Basketball podcast. We did a 15 and 60 yesterday, and we also introduced the Twitter NBA show, which we're going to do for the first time on Wednesday. That is a live streaming show from Twitter's headquarters. We'll do it at halftime of both games. It's Warriors, Raptors, and Grizzlies, Clippers. And then also a lengthy postgame show taking some questions, advanced stats, basically trying to give the Dunked On treatment to a halftime show, something that we have felt like is long overdue. Also, we're sponsored today by our old friends at Indochino, where you can get a custom-made suit for a mere $389 by entering that cap space code at checkout. And also a new sponsor today, one that I think is actually quite apropos for our current times, Thomson Reuters, a video news app for busy people with unbiased, unfiltered, and concise content. You can find out more about them at reuters.tv/capspace. So let's get to some news first. We haven't had a chance to do a ton of that yet, most of it around injuries, but let's get a start with just some news about the D-League from Mark Stein, just a little bit more trickling out in the CBA. Salaries under the new CBA in the D-League are expected to jump from $50,000 to $75,000, and two-way contracts would enable NBA teams to maintain 18-man rosters instead of the current max of 16, that per Mark Stein. Danny, your thoughts?
It's definitely a good start. I mean, I think that one of the big questions that will be need to be addressed in all of this, and something actually that was talked about on the coaches edition of Open Court, was the idea of active roster spots versus, you know, inactive. And the idea, D'Antoni is actually the one who brought it up, about telling a guy who's on your bench who's healthy that he can't play. And the D-League expansion and the two-way contracts are a great step. It certainly helps that. And it will, I hope that they address that kind of coinciding question as well.
The big news to me is that the D-League salaries currently, although they do get free room and board, are like 20 grand, even less than that in some cases. And 50 to 75, now you're getting pretty competitive with all but the highest European salaries. When you consider there's a chance to stay home, maybe a chance to get called up, I think this could have the D-League quality of play increase significantly, which is useful both for players who are trying to improve, who are on assignment from their NBA teams, and also just for people who are going to want to watch the D-League as well. There might actually be some decent big men in the league now, which we haven't seen much of. And I think for all but, you know, the biggest European teams, these are going to be pretty competitive offers, especially when you consider that there's kind of this inflection point at which you decide to go over to Europe in the first place if you're an American. And European teams generally don't like younger American players that much. You really have to go over to Europe and, similar to the NBA, build up your career. You have to prove that you can be valuable in that setting. You have to prove that you can handle it culturally, both on and off the floor, that you want to be there. And then if you're a really good American player, European teams are willing to pony up and pay you six figures. They're willing to even pay you maybe, you know, in over $1 million if you're really good. But you're not going to get that generally if you're just right out of college and you weren't drafted in the NBA. Like, those players aren't good enough yet for European teams to want to throw out that amount of cash. So instead, those players now are more likely to stick around in the U.S. and maybe they never end up leaving as a result of that, or maybe they don't leave until they're 25, 26 or something like that. And I like this. I like the fact that, like, in the U.S. we have way more money than the European leagues do. And so why shouldn't we be putting sort of that, some of that money to having a better minor league and also to just getting the best players here?
I'm excited to see how this also affects the interplay with high school guys that either don't qualify for college or don't want to play in college. And there is
that's a great point too.
There is this issue, you know, the highest end guys, you know, the Emmanuel Mudiers of the world will probably get more money overseas. Like, Moutier, it was that he got $1 million, right, to play in China? That's the number?
Yeah, it was around there. Brandon Jennings was in that range as well. I think Moutier was 1.2. Brandon Jennings might have been like high six figures.
Yeah, so those kind of guys will probably, that you're still not competitive there, though you do have the idea of future money and just not having to deal with all the cultural stuff. But for the next kind of tier down, it could be a great thing, especially for those guys who their issues are maybe that they don't qualify academically. And you do run into an issue where those players will still have to go into the draft. So teams do not have the incentive to really, not necessarily develop them, but to play them a lot. But it still opens up that door, which, you know, I'm morally opposed to the age limit, always have been. And this gets it a little bit closer to being, you know, let's call it semi-permeable, even though those guys couldn't play in the NBA that year.
Donatas Mata-Yunas, we haven't talked about his situation. He had his qualifying offer actually expire. It was $4.4 million. So he now cannot take that. Houston let it expire, but they still have him as a restricted free agent. So basically, I'm not sure what the end game is here for Mata-Yunas. This is is a few weeks ago, but he reportedly, I think this was Stein as well, had a $7 million offer with incentives that could have taken it to $8 million, and then a second year non-guaranteed. That seems really low from the Rockets, but again, they are a team that has always prized their flexibility. I don't think that Demo would help that much with what they're trying to do right now, because they just need more defense, and that's not necessarily his forte. Maybe he's just waiting for the inevitable Nene injury, because they just have absolutely nothing at backup center. If Nene goes out, and then it's going to be Harrell, it's going to be Onuaku. Like, those guys are not sufficient as backup centers, most likely. So maybe he's hoping something's going to happen to increase his leverage. Anything else to add to that on his situation?
We'll have to see. There aren't that many teams that have a ton of cap flexibility, and especially if you want something multi-year. And I'm sure it also makes him a little bit uncomfortable that, as we saw, though it didn't end up manifesting itself with Amir Johnson and Jarebko, a reasonable deal with a non-guaranteed second also makes a player an interesting trade target. And it would be awkward to kind of be signed and immediately be a trade asset, though he couldn't be traded immediately. And so, you know, maybe if he's happy in Houston, you get into that circumstance. But it has to resolve at some point, because, you know, otherwise this whole dance starts again next year.
Well, and maybe the compromise is, that's Tyler Zeller money is what they're offering him. It's basically, Zeller was in almost an identical situation as Money Unis was. They still have his capitals. They can basically pay him whatever they want to this year. And Zeller got 2 years, $16 million with the second year nine guaranteed. So there's no way Money Unis deserves less than Tyler Zeller. He's much better than Zeller, back injury or no. And so I think I certainly would feel aggrieved if I were him. He hasn't made a ton so far in his career, so that's certainly going to be part of this. And, you know, if he doesn't sign a contract this year, then he just becomes a restricted free agent again next year. And maybe the thought is that with the new restricted free agency rules, if he just sits out a year, that maybe things will be better. Or maybe he goes to play in Europe, if just to make some money and stay in shape this year, if in fact the Rockets never come up with an offer. But maybe the potential for compromise here is for them to still give him the nine guarantee, but just pay him more this year. Like, that only costs them money, basically. And that then they can get their flexibility for next year. And also, Muddy Unis can feel like he got at least a little bit of a win over someone like Tyler Zeller. I certainly understand why he's not taking that 1 year, basically $7 million offer. And you have no upside because you're locked up the next year, too.
Yeah, that's certainly fair. While we're on the subject of aggrieved players, do we want to talk about the rumored requested trades?
Yeah, this was also from Stein, who is at a lot of news lately in one of his columns. Willie Cauley-Stein apparently would like to be moved from Sacramento. Surprising, the first player ever to want to be moved from Sacramento. But he is playing basically as a center off the bench, not playing hardly any minutes at all with Cousins, as he did as a starter for most of last year. Let's say the Kings tried to grant his request and move him. He was the number six pick in 2015. Didn't get anything for him?
Well, anything is probably a yes.
Well, anything is a first round, like enough to bother trading him, which would be probably a first round pick.
I don't think you could get a late first for him at this point, but you could get a strong second.
That's pretty awful if he was the number six pick.
It is, but he hasn't shown that much improvement, and he strikes this strange balance as a center who isn't, you know, he's obviously has flaws offensively, but defensively, he's better as kind of a switch center than as a rim protector defensive anchor. And, you know, there is a value to that, but it's a very different thing than just that player you can plug and play. And so that makes projecting his, like him reaching whatever you consider his ceiling, less likely in terms of overall impact.
Yeah, I really don't know who even would want him, because he doesn't even look that good at the things that he was supposed to be good at. He just doesn't look that athletic. His hands are just awful. He's not really shown this incredible versatility switching out in the perimeter, has not shown much defensive intelligence. I mean, he was supposed to be a Tyson Chandler who could also switch out in the perimeter and guard, and that's just not what he is at this point in his career. And that's one of the things that is dependent on physical attributes as much as it is on your mental game and improvement. And he just hasn't shown the physical attributes, the coordination, and not to mention the mental part of it, playing really hard. So, I forgot to turn off my Twitter notifications. And somebody just sent me a tweet saying that Chris Middleton would be a way better fit on the Warriors than Klay Thompson. So I got distracted by that and almost had to respond.
But, yeah.
So that more Aaron is now getting some love on Dunktown, but much like when some idiot runs out on the field nude, we will not be actually giving him the dignity of saying what that Twitter handle is.
Good.
Let's move on to something that's actually important, though not basketball related. And that's been really the news. And there's been a lot of reports about just fake news getting like 500,000 likes on Facebook, or people who are basically in a bubble now when it comes to news. And you're not seeing other viewpoints. You're only seeing your own. That's really the internet age, many said, would really expose people to so many different viewpoints. But instead, it's allowed people to curate their own content and not see what the other viewpoints are, and in some cases what the truth is. And I think that's true on both sides of the political spectrum. But Reuters TV is trying to address that. It's a video news app for busy people. It's great for cord cutters. You can get caught up on all the day's news, minus the hot air and the talking heads. The content is unbiased, it's unfiltered, it's concise. Real journalists stationed across the globe who are on the scene, and it's curated for you, but it's also based on how much time you have. So they can create a personalized playlist with a mix of the day's top stories from around the world. And Reuters is a long time wire service. I think they even predate the AP, I want to say. And so they do not have an axe to grind. And I think that that's important in terms of getting your news a little bit more unfiltered than the particular lens that a lot of people want to get their stuff from. And you can even watch it offline as well if you're trying to get it on your morning commute. So, and it's available for both iPhone and Android. When you get started with them, Reuters.tv/capspace to start watching free today. That's Reuters.tv/capspace. So yeah, it's free. That's another awesome part about it as well. Reuters.tv/capspace. What else we got here for news?
Well, so Al Horford is still, he's still out. He actually participated in shoot around today, but then he didn't play in the game against the Pelicans. And the hope is that he will be back for their game on Wednesday.
Yeah, that's at home against the Mavericks. And then they have that Warriors game coming up. Jay Crowder also hoping to be back for the revenge game against the Mavericks from his sprained, I think it was left ankle. Bad news for the Knicks. Lance Thomas, we wondered why he hadn't played at all over the weekend in the 15 and 60 against the Raptors, and he has a bone bruise in his right ankle and also is dealing with plantar fasciitis in both feet, so he may be out for a while. The Knicks cannot particularly afford that, especially because they're now going to be trying to go small more, as we'll get to talking about the Dallas and Knicks game. So that's really a concern, and Thomas was always a candidate to regress this year. Hasn't been that bad when he's been out there, but the Knicks bench has been awful most of the year when they're not playing the Mavericks, and so they're going to have to find some other production from guys like Kuzminskis. So we'll have to go with more two big lineups. Hernan Gomez will probably get some more time. O'Quinn will probably get some more time. Dirk Nowitzki is not back yet. He tried to maybe come back against the Knicks. I think Dallas is kind of in the, hey, he's questionable, so you have to prepare for him, but he's not actually coming back soon phase, because he said, a quote from Earl Sneed, "The biggest issue is just the running. I'm not a big runner at this stage of my career, but I can't really go up and down yet." And that's actually a concern, because when he came back before, you'll recall, he actually said he felt fine, and then he re-injured it very quickly. So he's not even at the point where he was where he came back before. You'd have to imagine that there's going to be a fair amount more time missed, if in fact that's true from Dirk and he's not just kind of sandbagging it.
Two other guys that are going to be out for a little longer before we get to the more positive news. Al Farouq Aminu has a calf strain. He's out for a couple weeks at least, and Myers Leonard is starting in his place, so you're getting another two big lineup in Portland. And then Festus Ezeli suffered, regrettably, another setback with additional swelling, so I believe there is not yet a timetable for him.
Yeah, calf strains are bad, in case you didn't realize. Like, guys miss, if someone has a calf strain and they can't play, like, they're going to miss 2 weeks, 3 weeks, probably. And it's something that's very, very easy to re-injure. I, of course, have dealt with that injury, as I have perhaps literally every other injury at one point, and that's it's difficult, because you can't jump, you can't run without using your calf, and if you really try to go full speed, you're going to re-injure it, unless it's like absolutely perfect. Here's one that's Jared Bayless has been dealing with a wrist injury now for almost 2 months. He is assigned to the D League. That means he'll be back soon. When I ask you, do you think once he is healthy and back to himself, would you be starting him or would you be starting Rodriguez?
I would start Rodriguez until Ben Simmons is back. Rodriguez, especially if you're going to start Embiid. I think they have better chemistry, and you kind of want a guy who can orchestrate, unless you really want to give Dario Saric the reins for that, and I don't think that I would. So until that point, start Sergio and have Bayless, but I also don't think it's that big a deal, considering the stakes are not exactly high for the Philadelphia 76ers this season.
Yeah, and they got destroyed on the road against, well, they might be high for Brett Brown, but
yes, that's true.
Yes, they will not be in playoff contention, that's for sure. A few other things here. Damian Jones, the Warriors first round draft pick, number 30 out of Vanderbilt. He was tore his pectoral trying to bench press 185 pounds as many times as he could at a team workout, which seems like if I were him, I'd be pretty annoyed that some team asked me to do that. That has nothing to do with playing basketball at all. And that's not how I would want to miss 6 months of my career, but he should be back. He's trying to play in the D League as early as maybe November 25th. And then Alvin Gentry confirmed a report from Woj that Jrue Holiday should be back within this week. And we just got to hope for the Pels can hold on. AD now is dealing with a bunch of injuries. He's was getting treatment on his right knee during this game, and also his back is bothering him. And he said that that's really been tightening up whenever he sits on the bench in the Celtics game, although they did win. We're going to talk a little bit more about the ending of that game in a bit. Oh yeah, another Kings potential trade rumor as well.
Yeah, well, not only including the murmurs about DeMarcus Cousins again, which have been floating around in the ether for the last day, and you and I aren't firing up the trade checker yet, but Omri Caspi, there were these reports from Sport 5 in Israel that he would like to be traded. Caspi then basically denied it, and kind of around that same time he did get a little bit more minutes, which is something you and I have advocated for a long time.
Yeah, it was interesting that that report came out, and Caspi, as you mentioned, denied it and then played a little bit more. But yeah, there are a lot of teams that could use him, including the Sacramento Kings, and we'll see whether he keeps playing. I assume if he starts getting more regular minutes, then they're not gonna be yanking him around like this. And I think maybe with the way that they struggled to score against the Lakers, that maybe that led to and maybe he only played because Portland plays more of an up-tempo, spread-the-floor type of style. But the Kings need more offense on the floor, and he's one of the few, I think, who can provide. And he's been good the last 2 years. Last one here, Patrick Beverley should actually be back relatively soon. It sounds like impressive that he's been able to return, you know, in less than 6 to 8 weeks, which most people do for meniscus injuries. But that guy's a badass. I just hope he's able to stay healthy, and that this we have not seen a good recovery for guys who have spent less than the 6 to 8 weeks on these meniscus injuries. So he may be feeling well now. That's encouraging, but let's hope that there aren't any further knee issues for him down the road.
And the Rockets can really use him, because even if Beverly doesn't start, they're playing Tyler Ennis and Bobby Brown kind of to fill that backup role, and he's a whole lot better than they are.
Yeah, this is one of those ones where it's not like he's even so great. It's just he's a competent NBA player replacing guys who are really have been an issue. I mean, he's not going to fix their biggest problem, which is trying to score on the second unit, but at least just by getting Ennis out of there, he should be able to help a little bit. All right, you want to talk some games here?
Yeah, let's start with a legitimately gross basketball game that was, are we going to call it the Frank Vogel revenge game? Because he certainly didn't get much of it.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's only apropos that Frank Vogel, a guy who shepherded some of the league's best defenses and also worst offenses during his time in Indiana, that the Frank Vogel Bowl would just be such an ugly basketball game. I think everyone knew that that was going to be the case after Orlando had that emotional win, where the guys like Ibaka played a ton of minutes in Oklahoma City, and Oklahoma City as well had the same problems as kind of a schedule loss flying from Oklahoma City to the Midwest. And early on, it looked like they just didn't have the juice at all. All their jumpers were short, as Quinn Buckner, he did a nice job actually in this game on the Pacers broadcast, I thought. And they were able to bring it back through about 30, even through halftime, to keep it close. And then they just ran completely out of gas in the second half.
And of course, all of that is attributable to Kevin Serafin.
Well, at least according to the Pacers broadcast, he was like, you know, hero of the game, or, you know, whatever, sponsor of the game, pacer of the game, and got interviewed at the end. And he did play well. I don't mean to denigrate what he was able to do. He actually took Al Jefferson's minutes in the second half after the Pacers again struggled with Big Al on the floor. They tried going with Lavoie Allen to provide maybe a little bit more defensive support for Big Al, and that worked okay. But again, that you're the whole idea of Big Al is you're going to post him up, and then you have all this shooting around him, and he's going to be the big scoring guy in the second unit. He has not really been able to provide that so far. And then Serafin, he blocked some shots, had a couple of nice passes. One of the things I noted about him when I wrote the Pacers profiles for insiders is that he nearly doubled his assist rate last year with New York, presumably because he was was playing in the triangle a lot. And I also wrote that they're never going to use that aspect, but he still did have a couple of sweet passes on backdoors, one to Monte Ellis, who played well in this one. And yeah, it was just, again, Vogel was searching with Orlando for some lineups, and just it doesn't seem to be working for them at all offense.
Yeah, they shot 32% from the field, 20% from three. Combined, both teams shot 23 free throws. So even though a free throw game isn't fun, at least you can be efficient from there. But they didn't do much of that. It was just not the most fun basketball game. But at the same point, you know, to a degree, that is, you know, it was kind of a victory for the Pacers to actually stop someone, even if the Magic did a lot of it themselves.
Yeah, these teams didn't get to the line at all, and there were a combined 13 out of 50 from three between the two of them. The Pacers 39% shooting destroyed the Magic's, as you said, 32% shooting. It was an 88-69 win for the Pacers, and just everybody didn't have it for Orlando. Ibaka, 3 out of 13, a lot of mid-rangers from him. Vucevic, 1 out of 10, a ton of mid-rangers from him. Elfrid Payton played a little bit better. He was probably the best magician, I guess you would call him, on this night. And he actually had a great game in Oklahoma City last night with 23 points, but even Payton only had 12 points in 29 minutes. And Vogel was, Jeff Green started again. Aaron Gordon came in. He was at one point was 2 out of 7. His two makes were at the rim, and then all of his jumpers missed. He finished 1 out of 4 from three-point range, and also wasn't able to get much going on jumpers from two-point land. Damian Rudej played a bunch. He's not really an NBA player. CJ Watson played 17 minutes, part of it garbage time, but they played Watson and Augustin and Payton all together at the same time. It really just was not making much sense at all.
This is a largely unrelated point, but if you are choosing a team name and you cannot figure out if when you're deciding, it is not abundantly clear what a player on that team would be called, please pick a different team name. It's such a silly yeah, thing, but it's a good
thunder,
it's a good canary
a
in the coal mine.
Yeah, that's a great point. I hadn't thought of it that way, but that's really, I mean, are there any, yeah, I guess the Jazz, yeah, are there any
the
non
thunder.
Yeah, are there any non-plural team nicknames that can be like changed into like a singular person?
I can't think of any offhand, but there could be. Some listener will go through it and think of it, and I will appreciate it.
What is the least offensive of the non-plural team name?
Probably the Magic, because at least that makes sense as a concept. Like, at least Magic is kind of, and it also ties in with the area because of Disney World and all that kind of stuff. And if the Jazz was in New Orleans, it would be that, but it's not, and that makes me angry to no end.
Yeah, that's true. It's pretty remarkable that they didn't change the name when they moved. It's not like the New Orleans Jazz was some great brand in 1980 when they moved to Utah. Yeah, like the Heat makes sense because it's Miami. I would say the Heat is probably the best one too. And at least the Jazz have a good logo.
Oh, well, I mean, yeah, the logo is beautiful. I'm a big fan. I mean, I've nearly bought a Pete Maravich Jazz jersey a couple times. I mean, I think that they've gone through a couple of nice iterations too. The Mountain jerseys were also nice, but that wasn't the logo, that was the jersey.
All right, we're about to turn into another basketball podcast that will remain unnamed that I've also appeared on before. if we keep this up. By the way, Serafin, in his wonderful game, he was plus 14, but he still was only 3 out of 8 from the field. Part of that due to playing in garbage time. Did have 5 offensive rebounds, which was pretty impressive. But I mean, probably the biggest stat from this game, CJ Miles had a game high 16 points.
Ugh. Well, let's talk about a more interesting game and Knicks Mavericks, which at least had a wrinkle in the second half that was intriguing and fun.
Yeah, it was. Joakim Noah did not have it today. There was one play that I tweeted out in the first half where Porzingis was trying to guard Harrison Barnes. They took Barnes off a screen. Porzingis wasn't able to stick with him. And then Barnes just went right down the lane. Noah was just standing basically in the restricted area the entire time and never moved to get his body in front of him, never jumped. Bogut got 3 offensive rebounds in the first 5 minutes of the game at Noah's expense in this one too. And so Jeff Hornacek, what I thought was a brilliant move, because the Mavs basically are only playing one traditional big. Powell and Bogut are basically it for them, maybe Mejri playing a little bit too alongside Powell. But he went out and he put Porzingis at center against Bogut, and that broke the game open. It had been this slugfest. It was like 40 to 40 or something at halftime. And immediately the Knicks went on a really nice run. I think they were up 61-47, and that was basically about it, mostly due to the fact that Bogut had no chance of keeping up with Porzingis. And then he started doing his, I'm going to commit ridiculous fouls because I don't want to be in this game anymore. more approach. Derrick Rose was able to drive to the basket when Bogut got pulled away from the rim. Carmelo Anthony got going with some nice deep post-ups. He had struggled in the first half and then was able to take guys like Wes Matthews right down onto the block, and Bogut wasn't able to help because of Porzingis' shooting. It was really outstanding, and I think that while that unit could struggle on the glass, I mean, they've been terrible defensively anyway, so you might as well just try to get more offense out there. And I don't think Noah played at all in the second half, and it looked really good. And of course, while because it's the Knicks, even a moment of triumph has to be sullied by the fact that, oh yeah, this is probably the way they should have been playing, and they just dumped $18 million a year for the next 4 years into Joakim Noah.
Yeah, it made me frustrated during the game, because while Porzingis at center is not the end-all be-all for the Knicks, especially in the short term, it is a great thing to be able to fall back on at certain moments. I got mad even in the first quarter when they pulled Noah and Porzingis at the same time. And it is also worth noting that at present, especially without Lance Thomas, as we talked about in the newser, they don't have enough swingmen to really log too many minutes there, because they play Justin Holiday. He did a nice job against, incidentally, a lot of it against former teammate Harrison Barnes. But, you know, they don't have enough guys to do that a ton. But against the Mavericks, it worked really well. Bogut hates defending in space, and there wasn't somebody else on that Knicks team to put him on. You know, Melo would have cooked him. Holiday, you know, can just hang out on the perimeter, and you have to respect that. And so they were able to take advantage of the space that was created by having that. And yeah, you are giving things back on the defensive end in all likelihood, but you're creating space for guys who absolutely need that as a part of their game.
It was just a nightmare game for the Mavs, only putting up 77 points. It was 93-77, and they shot 5 out of 28 on three. Seth Curry was 1 out of 7. Barea was 1 out of 5. Barnes, again, had 20 points on relatively efficient, but no Maverick other than Barnes shot more than 2 free throws. And in fact, Mavericks other than Barnes shot only 5 free throws, and that makes sense because they don't really have anyone else who gets to the line on this team. Justin Anderson, it's been a struggle for him. He was 0 for 11, 0 for 5 on three. And these are not really looking very close either. And we saw him in person against the Warriors, I think it was Friday, and he's got to be able to shoot better, or he's not. And this is a great moment for him to be seizing minutes. Like, he could be playing as a small ball four, and he's actually losing minutes to Dorian Finney-Smith, who's undrafted out of Florida right now, because he just cannot hit a shot. It's really looked bad for Anderson. And we always wondered how real his shooting was in Virginia that year. His senior year, he had been a non-shooter before that, shot well in summer league. His rookie year had some moments shooting the ball this year, but then just has been way off as well. And Justin Holiday, whom you mentioned, plus 30, 6 out of 7 from the field, 2 of 3 on threes for 16 points. He did have a couple of nice blocks on Harrison Barnes as well. So if he can, again, Holiday has never actually, he looks good shooting it, but he's never actually been able to be efficient shooting it. If he could emerge to be just a passable rotation player of this team, it really changes a lot for them.
It does. And you know, it's going to be exciting to see if the Knicks go back to this, even if it's not constantly just enough to realize it. One of the things that I've pushed for is, even under this kind of system that they have, just give Porzingis a little bit of an early hook, let him do some stuff with the second unit. A lot of teams play those traditional, like, kind of bully fives, and he can just mess with them and do really well. And so try to get into a rotation that can work with everybody, especially when they're playing Melo. And I think Melo and Lee both played the entire first quarter, so you could figure out a rotation that really works for Melo to help get him going too.
Yeah, the Knicks bench did not get killed in this one, which was nice. Kyle O'Quinn actually barely played at the end, which was surprising to me too, that they went back to Hernan Gomez after O'Quinn really outplayed him in that Toronto game. But Hernan Gomez at least managed to not be in the negative. And of course, this Dallas bench is very, very limited, so I'm not going to say that the Knicks bench problems are solved at all. Also, Derrick Rose was not very good in this one. 3 points on 1 of 6 from the field, and he actually complained that he wasn't getting any foul calls on all of his drives to the basket. He's been getting to the basket more. He didn't have to do that much in this one, but he only, again, got 2 free throw attempts. Here, anything you took away from the Mavericks side at all?
I want to see them at full strength, but I also was, I was sitting there, and I don't know if you saw our friend Tim McMahon's tweet, but he was talking about...
Yeah, I was just going to talk about that.
It got dark, but it was about the idea of, you know, like, maybe the best case scenario for this is that Harrison Barnes looks good and they get a high lottery pick. And I was just sitting there going, ooh, when you're you know, earlier than 20 games into the season, and you're already starting to say that. It's a little bit sad, especially when the Mavericks are, you know, they certainly have some interesting players. Wes Matthews is doing well. Harrison Barnes has looked better, but it's not like they're, let's say, the Nuggets or even the Sixers, where, you know, they're on the up and up. It's just that they're in those struggling phases of the process. This is a team with a lot of older players on it as well.
Yeah, and it's not going to get any better, this game at Boston, especially if Boston is again at full strength. Dirk, if he does play, and we don't think he's going to, he's going to be limited in terms of his minutes. Deron Williams still has that calf issue, and Rick Carlisle said it's not impossible, which means it's not very possible that he's going to be playing anytime soon. So that'll be 2-8 now if they lose at Boston, and it could be curtains pretty quickly here, especially because they're, I mean, at least I don't think this is going to be one of those years where like 38 wins get you, and like, you probably got to at least get to 41 wins, and I don't know that this team at full strength, when Dirk is playing, if they're going to stop anyone. I mean, that's the one silver lining, is their defense has actually been okay, but once you get Dirk out there, I think it's going to look a lot worse again, and they'll be better offensively. They'll probably be good again offensively, but it's still adding up to more than an average team is difficult, and there's 6 wins in the hole now.
So as somebody who thinks that 82 games is too many for a season, the Oklahoma City Detroit game felt like confirmation of that, because the Thunder just were flat. They had played that big game, they lost. I mean, Russ still put up his numbers.
This whole night of basketball actually was, I thought, was very much a, this was like our first, all right, there are too many games day of the season.
Yeah, and so I also thought it was hilarious. Royce Young tweeted out during the game that I believe the Thunder broadcast chose Jeremy Grant as player of the game, despite Russell Westbrook having 33 points, 15 rebounds, and 8 assists. It's like, I guess they're getting bored of it, but just they should just give him a clean sweep for the season.
Yeah, it's funny when teams do that, but it really is apropos, because they don't have anyone else who's reliable. Even, and it was interesting, Royce Young was tweeting out during the game that Steven Adams, he thought, had been a disappointment after getting this contract. And Adams only has about a 14.9 PR. He's been relatively efficient, hasn't been as good on the offensive glass as you might like, only about 10% offensive rebound rate. Hasn't been able to really up his usage. I think when he's gotten some post-ups, he's looked okay, but he hasn't been the pick-and-roll threat, in large part because they haven't had the spacing. But do you agree? Do you think, have you been disappointed by his performance so far this year?
No, I think agree. He was a part of their defensive success early on, and he actually looked more disciplined offensively, but they're not putting him in a great situation. You know, a guy like him, he's kind of like that low usage, high efficiency big, so you give him a few touches and see if he does well, and then there was, you just like let him scrap and let him set good screens, and they just don't have enough around to really make that work. And then defensively, you know, they're getting into these weird spots. They're playing him with a rookie, Sabonis. You know, Sabonis has looked better than we expected, but you still have those kind of issues. And then while he's not playing that much with Joffre LaVerne and Enes Kanter, those guys are both traditionally sieves, and so you're creating a lot for a guy who's supposed to be a defensive stopper. And then when you go with a guy like Jeremy Grant, talented guy, athletic, but can't shoot, so it basically every guy they can play him with on the interior exacerbates some sort of problem that makes life harder on Mr. Adams.
I did caution that while Steven Adams, that wasn't, I don't think, necessarily a bad contract that he got, that 4 years, $100 million, and it was market rate. He's not that good of a player yet. Like, he's going to have to grow into that contract. He had some moments in the playoffs, but I think people are still overstating how good he was in the playoffs. He had he was very good at certain times, but overall, maybe not as good as people remember. And then he hadn't been that good in the regular season before that. And so expecting that he's going to duplicate that playoff production immediately may have been unrealistic. I think he has enough talent, as I said, to grow into that contract, but to say that, oh, the Thunder have two max players on their team right now, Steven Adams and Russell Westbrook, that's not realistic. He's not that guy yet. He's been maybe slightly disappointing, but as you mentioned, I think a lot of that is more external factors. I haven't, in watching him, I haven't been like, oh, he's been bad. I haven't liked what I've seen from him. The statistical output, but hasn't quite been there. So yeah, and he wasn't really good in this game, did not close this game, although there wasn't really much to close, as it was kind of a blowout, but I don't think he even came back in the fourth quarter at all. The guy I really wanted to talk about from this game, who we hit on a little bit in the 15 and 60, was Tobias Harris, who had 22 points, and I thought was outstanding.
He looked really confident out there, and Tobias Harris does a nice job when he feels like he has the advantage on the guy that's guarding him, and it looked like he felt that way for the entire night. So he was just driving, he was taking good shots, and, you know, this was a game that I didn't expect the Pistons to look as sharp as they did in, because they were playing without Andre Drummond, but those support
and
players
Jackson,
are the guys
of course,
that would...
too. I mean, that's the, yeah, that's their two best players, and they blew out this Thunder team.
Yeah, and KCP looked pretty solid too, but I wanted to go back quickly to one Adams point, just because I looked it up and didn't want to let it go to waste. The Thunder are allowing 95.6 points per 100 possessions with Adams out there, and then, you know, a lot more than that when he's out.
Yeah, they're
but
plus
it's more
8 up going into tonight when he was out there, you know, and that's...
Yeah,
that,
it's
I mean,
plus 7.6 yeah. now.
He's not the problem if you're going to say, hey, there's a lot more things that are disappointing, including Victor Oladipo so far on this team.
Yeah, but let's give credit to the Pistons. I thought they did a really nice job tonight, kind of top to bottom, and Benno also had a nice game, and that's one of the important aspects of the Pistons this year. Is last year they were sabotaged by not having any backup point guards, especially after they traded Brandon Jennings. Right now, Ish Smith is doing, you know, a solid enough job replacing Reggie Jackson, and then Benno, who they got off the scrap heap from the Heat, they claimed him off the waiver wire, I believe, he's doing a nice little job for them.
Yeah, I would even say that they're winning in spite of what Smith is doing at the moment, just because he's been so incredibly inefficient, as we talked about yesterday on the 15 and 60. But yeah, Benno was solid, 10 points plus 13. Again, that Pistons bench got killed all the time, and instead they actually were able to hold the lead and break it open finally down the end. Smith actually, of course, did shoot 50% today, but only had 3 assists in his 30 minutes. Boban got some minutes. I thought that he looked solid, at least in his second half minutes, getting some shot blocks, going up against... He was a nice antidote to the lineup of Cantor and Adams together, which Donovan started to roll out. And Donovan also seemed like he was pressing. Perhaps also this is just a question of them being on the second game of a back-to-back, but it was Lavernier playing with Sabonis a lot. He actually started Jeremy Grant in the second half because they wanted to get more defense and mobility on the floor against Marcus Morris and the aforementioned Harris. And Harris, really, what I liked about him, he is turning what was, I wouldn't say necessarily a weakness, but he looked like he was sort of jack of all trades, master of none offensively. And now he's actually gotten to where he's getting to be above average at a lot of these things. Like his spot up jumper just looks great. He's hopping into it, no conscience, quick release, both from two and from three as well. Really looking like a solid spot up option who's going to need to be guarded. He got some nice post ups. They lobbed it into him on switches and he was able to score. Got out in transition, had a nice dunk as well. He looks more explosive, more confident, and you know, there's nobody really on the Thunder who's going to take advantage of him defensively in this game, but the Pistons overall have been defending better, and I think his improvement has been a part of that.
Yeah, and it's been, you know, it's been kind of nice in a way to see this. I talked about it a little bit with the Jazz and other times, that when major players that are often the focus of an offense go out, either the team can crater or other guys can build up their confidence, and Harris deserves a lot of credit for embracing that change, and hopefully that's something he can carry forward.
And I hope they keep going to him too once Reggie Jackson comes back. For the Thunder, they still are just desperately searching for shooting. Alex Abrines, 17 minutes, 1 out of 7. Alex is now shooting 34% on the season. He's taking 3/4 of his shots from three, only 29% from three. And he is a pretty good shooter. I saw him warming up in that OKC game at Golden State, and you can tell a lot from those. He definitely has a pure stroke, but he also, I think, is still making the adjustment. And it may not be until next year that we really see him as a guy who's going to go out there and drain shots. And of course, the calls for Anthony Morrow have started again. And I mean, pretty amazing to think that he's 30 years old now, but maybe they just need to play him. And Westbrook was brilliant again in this game, but just they had no help whatsoever.
Yeah, and I'm just openly dubious of the Cantor-Laverne combination, just because I don't think
Laverne cannot defend. That's his problem. Yeah, he's got like the prettiest hook shot in the league that never goes in with both hands.
But it's also the diminishing returns. I mean, there's definitely a reason to have Enes Kanter out there. He's a talented scorer, can be a good rebounder, but it's like, if you're going to play Enes Kanter, you already have Steven Adams. What's the point of playing Joffrey Laverne? Just play somebody else.
Yeah, I agree. Oladipo was 4 out of 17 in this one too, 1 out of 7 on threes. It's been a struggle for him. His line so far this year, shooting only 40% from the field. He has been hitting his three-pointers a little bit, not getting to the foul line much either, only 32 foul shots in 11 games. You'd like to see it. This is a guy who's supposed to be attacking the rim, and they just don't have a second scorer on this team. We thought that this would be the case, and they're just going to have to play with awesome effort defensively every night and just hope that Westbrook Bourque can carry him home on offense. And on the second night of a back-to-back against a good defensive team, you have to really bring it on defense. And they just didn't have that type of energy, I don't think, tonight.
No, they didn't. And, you know, we'll see how it goes moving forward. But I think I'm ready to move on to Celtics-Pelicans, which got really interesting.
No, you are not ready to move on yet because we have to do another commercial.
We can do that.
And that commercial, of course, is from our old friends at Indochino. They've actually been sponsoring the show now for over a year. And that's because so many of our listeners have used that cap space code, gotten a premium suit fitted for just $389. If you don't know what Indochino is yet, it's basically a made-to-measure suit that you can get for much cheaper than you could get at a department store. And I have, I think, six suits now. Two of them are from Indochino. And I always wear the Indochino ones first. I like the way that they fit better. They just, I have kind of huge shoulders and then a smaller chest and waist. And so while they say they're going to tailor your suit at a department store, that doesn't really ever seem to work out as well as just getting it custom fitted. If you live in a city where they have a store, you can just go in and they'll do it for you. Or they have a tutorial on their website on how to measure your body and get your suit fitted. And then 3 or 4 weeks later, once you input your measurements, they'll send it back to you. There's hundreds of fabrics and patterns. You can customize the lapels, the size of, if you want pleats, your jacket linings, the angle of the pockets, really anything that you want to do. And 4 weeks later, you'll get your suit. Don't forget, of course, to enter that cat space code at checkout at Indochino.com that lets them know that you came from us. And then you also get it for just $389. Never have to worry about expensive trips to the tailor again. That's another way that you save, is spending an extra $100 to get it tailored after you spend way more than you'd spend at Indochino at a department store. And you'll get the best fitting suit that you've ever owned. Indochino.com, promo code CAPSPACE. Yeah, so how much did you get to watch of this New Orleans-Boston game? I only got a chance to watch about the last, like, 3 or 4 minutes or so, but plenty to talk about just during that period.
I think I watched the last seven, so not that much more than you, kind of as the lead evaporated and then the kind of craziness that was the last few minutes of that game.
Yeah, the Pels did have the lead by 7 and actually got up by 10 with 9 minutes left, and then it pretty much dwindled. The Celtics went on an 8-0 run over about 3 minutes, and then the teams were essentially neck and neck the rest of that time. And I thought the Celtics did well to defend Anthony Davis. You can't say that he didn't get enough shots in this one. He was 7 out of 22, did get to the foul line quite a bit. That was the big thing that saved New Orleans in this one, especially a couple of just horrendous fouls down the end. I made the joke that for someone who can't jump, Kelly Olynyk sure commits a lot of fouls by jumping. And he had an over-the-back breaker trying to go up and get an offensive rebound over Anthony Davis. Like, guess what, Kelly? Like, you're not going to out-jump Anthony Davis for the rebound. And then the absolute killer was the Pelicans. After a no timeout situation, the Celtics ran a nice play with Isaiah Thomas to tie it up. And then Tim Frazier came down, got Kelly in the air with 2 seconds left, and just Kelly jumped and Frazier committed a foul. It was a clear foul. It was just a really dumb play by Olynyk.
Yeah, it was a really just kind of a dumbfounding thing because Frazier had gotten himself into a spot. I don't think that if Olynyk had done nothing, that Frazier would have gotten a good shot off. And Olynyk bailed him out and functionally ended the game because then Frazier made the first one, and it looked like he intentionally missed the second, which makes sense when you're ahead, when that puts you ahead by one and the other team doesn't have a remaining timeout.
Yeah, and then it turned out that the Pelicans knocked the ball out of bounds, so Boston did get a chance to inbound, and then that led to a hilarious situation where they tried to inbound it to half court, it got knocked out, and then with 0.1 seconds remaining, Tyler Zeller tried to throw an inbound pass that actually hit the rim that someone could tip in, and that ended the game. I thought down the stretch it was not a model of execution from the Pelicans. Despite that, like, they got one bucket on that Olynyk over the backbreaker to tie it up. The Celtics actually were ahead by 2. And then Olynyk missed a 3. AD got the rebound and they ran the clock down. This was out of a timeout. And Frazier was supposed to enter the ball to Davis by first giving it to Galloway, who was going to come off a screen. And that what happened was Davis got pushed out a little bit by Amir Johnson. And then Isaiah Thomas did a great job of denying the ball to Langston Galloway. But then Galloway just stood there. And so Frazier couldn't just get the ball to Davis directly. He had to try to just take his man one-on-one, which I think was Avery Bradley too, which was really difficult. And then he threw it to AD, who had to throw up a floater from like 16. That was a terrible shot. So that was really continuing some of the themes that we've had from the Pelicans, where they've been unable to get AD the ball right down the stretch. Even though he wasn't that efficient in this game, he's obviously the guy who has to get it. And I think against someone like Amir Johnson, he should be able to create a shot. And the Celtics are not a team that switches much. I think just going to a pick and roll early in the possession and then trying to get the ball to AD might work better, but just not great execution out of a timeout where you can't even get your best player a touch.
Yeah, there were a series of frustrating moments earlier in the fourth quarter where Davis just didn't get the ball. You know, they were trying other stuff and trying to get going. And one thing that I noticed over the course of the game is that Isaiah Thomas did a pretty nice job for the most part finishing towards the rim. He's just strangely talented at that because he's had to finish over taller guys basically his entire life. And he struggled from three. He actually was over 50% from inside the arc, and then below, I think he was exactly 30% outside of it. And that was even true in the last couple minutes. He had a nice layup that I believe put Boston the lead in the first place.
Yeah, there were two nice plays down the end from Brad Stevens. One of them was when it was tied after that AD miss. They took a timeout with about 35 seconds left, and they had a chance to get a 2-for-1. And Brad will run this play fairly often, where they actually bring IC all the way, they'll inbound from the side, but bring him all the way back into the backcourt so then he can get a running start. And getting a running start like that is a great way to get a 2-for-1, because you have that impetus going to the basket. And so Isaiah ended up getting fouled. He made 1 out of 2. Then Davis was able to come down, and he made both free throws after what was somewhat of a dubious call on Amir Johnson after AD missed his little floater in the lane. But you know, those are two kind of controversial calls, and AD made both of his free throws. Isaiah only made one. And then at that point was when Isaiah was able to come down again off of a sideline out of bounds. The Celtics ran, which I think Scalabrine actually called it on the broadcast. He's been great on there when he's not spreading completely unfounded trade rumors from bullshit sites. But he called that they're going to run this double loop play where they basically loop a guy around, and then Thomas gets a dribble handoff from him and gets to go to the basket with his left. He hit a nice floater, and that was when the Olynyk committed the foul against Frazier. So it was not the greatest execution by the Pels, but they got bailed out really by two Olynyk fouls. They didn't get any good shots in the last 2 minutes other than free throws for AD, none of which really came off at any type of execution.
And we'll see how kind of the narratives go with the Pelicans, because they beat the Bucks and they lost the Lakers, won this game, and then they face the Magic on Wednesday. So if they can win that game, then maybe you start to get those riding the ship narratives and all that. And you know, it's of course a good sign to see them do well, especially if they can get Drew back. But now is the time that they have to do that if they're going to make any sort of push for the playoffs.
Yeah, they're 2-9 right now, and we'll see how it goes. People were tweeting me like, oh, hey, are you guys like, are you down on the Celtics now? Like, hey, you're so high on the Celtics. Like, they're not looking like a top three seed. And like, yeah, they've been missing two of their three best players for the last 2 weeks. They're 5-5. And they're fine.
They also dealt with injuries throughout too. Marcus Smart being out,
Smart,
a lot of those things.
Was injured. You're right. It's way too early. Now, if they're 3 weeks from now, if they're healthy and they're still at 500, yeah, then you can color me concerned.
Sure.
What else we got here?
Jazz Grizzlies, which looked a lot more interesting on paper than it did once we found out who wasn't going to play.
Yeah, George Hill still out with this thumb thing. It really seems like the Jazz have been obfuscating there a little bit because he's been questionable for the last 5 games now. Hopefully it's not the kind of thing that he's actually going to need a procedure on. Derek Favors came back. He had to leave their previous game in Miami, I think after 6 minutes with a sore left knee. Started this game, started to play well, and then went out again. And it's just this thing with his knees, it's just really starting to raise some eyebrows for me. Like, why is he playing? And then he has to beg off after six minutes. He had missed nearly all of training camp. Like, we don't know what the knee issue actually is. It's just knee soreness. He had the same thing down the end of last year too. I think it was the same knee, as I recall, his left knee. Like, are you as concerned about this as I am?
I am. And it was also, we saw the effect kind of that when they ended up closing the game with Trey Lyles and Boris Diaw, and unsurprisingly, they got worked on the offensive glass.
Yeah, this continued a worrying trend from Quinn Snyder of not playing playing the guy that they basically just gave a max contract to, Rudy Gobert, at the end of games. Rudy Gobert might be the best defensive player in basketball, and he wasn't playing. And this wasn't a time where it's like, oh, they have so much shooting on the floor. The center was Marc Gasol for the other team. And yeah, I guess that Rudy had been in foul trouble. He'd gotten his fifth foul. He reacted in frustration and threw his mouthpiece when he just kind of got a dumb foul. I don't know whether it was with the call or with himself that he was frustrated. He got a dumb foul trying to hedge out in the perimeter 30 feet from the basket. You know, it was certainly frustrating. And people speculate, oh, it's because he threw his mouthpiece, and like Quinn he's been emphasizing not complaining to the refs. I'm like, all right, I hope that's not what it was, because like, this isn't high school. Like, you need to actually win the game. And at one point, the Grizzlies had 6 offensive rebounds and the Jazz had 5 defensive rebounds. And big surprise, when you have Zebo and Marc Gasol, and then they also got a huge call where Marc Gasol forced a loose ball foul on an offensive rebound too, where he clearly was pushed in the back when he had great position. So yeah, when you have those guys going against Trey Lyles and Boris Diaw, not a huge shock that you're going to get these offensive rebounds. And then Joe Johnson had a bad game, but they've been great with him at the four. I would have loved to have just seen him and Gobert. This is another one of those ones where, hey, we're going to go with like what the hot lineup is. That wasn't actually that hot. It's not like they were killing them. Like, they had like a nice, you know, like 10-4 run or something with Diaw and Lyles in there, but those guys aren't as good as Joe Johnson and Rudy Gobert, and it cost them in this game. I think that they could have won, and instead Memphis was able to pull away. It was a low scoring slugfest, and there were a bunch of fouls late. But yeah, that offensive rebounding really was the problem. And maybe Quinn felt like, all right, we need some more offense out there because Rodney Hood has an illness, and Shelvin Mack, who was pretty bad down the stretch of this one, he played instead of Exum. I don't really have an opinion on which of those two guys should play. They're both really below average options as starting point guards right now. So he felt like maybe they just couldn't score, and Rudy was going to help with that. But with that said, like, Rudy Gobert is just so much better than these other guys. Like, play him.
Which slow moving swingman who scored 20 points do you want to talk about? Joe Ingles or Vince Carter?
I think we should talk about Vince, because he's been fantastic. He is the oldest player, as another Tim McMahon tweet, the oldest player since Michael Jordan to actually score 20 points. Pretty remarkable at 40 years old what he's doing. He had a nice little dunk along the baseline too. I mean, he probably actually at this point in his career is a better dunker than Michael Jordan was at this point in his career. Mike actually wasn't amazing, but he could at least throw a couple down when he was 39 and 40 in those seasons with the Wizards. So yeah, he's been hitting his three-pointers. I think it was 3 out of 5 from there. He's been causing problems for smaller guards on post-ups, drawing double teams, and he's even played excellent defensively. You remember, he shut down Andrew Wiggins in the first game of the season, and he was part of making Gordon Hayward's first really bad night of the year for Hayward, who actually re-injured his hand, his finger, and had to get it taped up, but he was on a bad shooting night even before that.
You bring up a good point with the defense, but I also want to just go through his last 3 games in terms of scoring. So tonight, 20 points on 14 shooting possessions. The game before in Milwaukee, 17 points on 12 shooting possessions. And then Denver, which was his second game with 20 points, actually was his first, this was his second, he had 20 points on 14 shooting possessions. So that's really impressive for a bench guy, especially an older guy, but it's just impressive overall. And Memphis has struggled for years to get reliable scoring off their bench. And I don't think either of us would have necessarily expected it to come from Vince Carter, but it's certainly welcome.
And pretty amazing too. We were talking about how they were just gonna, Vince I think only had like $2 million guaranteed on his salary. Maybe it was even only $1 million this year. And we were talking about how, oh, they're just gonna cut him, or maybe they try to find a way to keep Matt Barnes. And he's been way better than Matt Barnes has been. And this is by far his best season in a Grizzlies uniform. You would have thought that the original season that he signed when he was only 37 would have been that. You mentioned Joe Ingles too. Joe was fantastic. 7 of 11, 4 of 7 on threes, 20 points in this one. He started at the 2. A lot of that was unsustainable type of stuff. He had one play that was late clock where he jabbed left, did a step back, jumped back to his right, really, and shot a 3. Not the type of thing that's going to be his game. But he is a nice option as really what's supposed to be the fifth wing on this team. And I also, just as someone who isn't now an old man, is going to need to be developing my old man game, I love the way that he finishes at the rim. He just takes his time, not even really a great guy with his offhand either, but he just gets it done. He wrong foots guys. He has beautiful Euro steps. He just goes up way slower, lets the defense fly by, or goes slowly enough that the defense can't time it and they can't jump either. And then he has the advantage. It's really remarkable. what he's able to do. I also thought Deontay Davis was pretty good in this game. Did you get to see any of his minutes?
I didn't really. What stood out to you was it? There are a lot of different things. He's intriguing on kind of different facets, athleticism, sometimes effort, depending. What stood out to you?
Yeah, I thought that just his physical tools were the number one thing that stood out. He was playing alongside Zach Randolph, and he was able to move his feet out on the perimeter, got some nice finishes inside. I mean, he looked like a center out there. And now they weren't playing with the biggest lineup, but in terms of like his ability to protect the rim and finish inside, maybe not in the post or defensive rebounding, but he looked like this is a guy who could be a center potentially. And I thought that his help instincts were pretty good. He got over, really changed some shots, slid his feet in pick and roll defense, just showed something for a guy that really has been totally off the radar screen because he wasn't able to play. He had that plantar fasciitis in summer league. We're like, yeah, this guy, I mean, and he's going to be really inconsistent, but just the raw tools, really the first time that I'd seen extended minutes from him at the NBA level, I thought that he's a guy who has some potential.
That's exactly what you're looking for when you get a guy in the high second round. I believe he got the most guaranteed money of any American-born second-round pick in history, and it was that he had a potentially high ceiling, and I remember some of the draft people I talked to were really high on him and thought he fell too far. And if he can play center, that really increases his value, because even if, as a second-unit guy, and he could be better than that eventually, teams need 48 good minutes from that position if he can protect the rim.
We've seen three high-profile guys this season who were scorers, former starters, go to the bench. Greg Monroe has done that in Milwaukee. I think he's been pretty successful. He has like a 23 PR right now. The Bucks have been scoring pretty well. And Al Jefferson, that has not done as well, but I think that might also be just because Al isn't that good anymore. And then Zach Randolph's the other one. I think that pretty unequivocally has worked. Zach has been efficient most nights. He's getting, you know, 14, 15 points. He really was a huge part of Memphis early in the fourth quarter when Gasol was out of the game. He was playing with Davis and played with Martin a little bit, and he was killing him on the offensive glass, getting his deep post-ups, hitting a couple of jumpers. He even attempted a shot with his right hand, which was amazing. And hilariously, it was right after he dove on the floor and cracked his right elbow on the ground. I was like, well, he doesn't need that thing anyway. And then he attempts like this first shot of his career with his right hand a little bit later on. But he's been good. He's provided that scoring. They don't have anyone to provide offense really on the second unit. It hasn't even been necessarily straight post-ups, but he's just been beasting some of these second unit guys. And Dia, Lyles, like those guys didn't have an answer for him.
It is not perfect against everyone, but particularly for teams that do not have a good second unit point guard, and Memphis absolutely fits that bill, having a kind of a guy that can be the hub can really help get things moving. Milwaukee, again, is another example of this, and you can see it work. It's helping some teams out and get some reliable offense.
Chandler Parsons did not play down the end of this game. He played 23 minutes, but I think most of it intentionally was early. That's probably right about where his limit is. He didn't play any of the minutes that I saw in the fourth quarter. Gasol was pretty good in this one as well. He had 22 points, and the Jazz weren't able to take advantage of what I'm starting to see as his increasing limitations defensively, like in that Bucks game over the weekend. Like Giannis was really killing him at the rim. He wasn't able to be quick enough or explosive enough to stop people the way he did back in his Defensive Player of the Year season. But the Jazz didn't have anyone who's going to take advantage of that in this one. And Mike Conley was his usual steady self. And Andrew Harrison, while he only had 5 points and was 1 out of 4, he was plus 6. And he looks like an NBA player out there. For a guy who was in the D League last year, he was ahead of Wade Baldwin in the rotation. Wade Baldwin didn't play in this one. I thought it was encouraging for him. He's not going to be some big scorer. He's probably going to struggle to be efficient. But his three-pointer looks at least like something that has to be mildly respected. He's not screwing up on defense. He looks like he's pretty quick. Like, he's actually, I think, at least so far, I mean, I don't want to say he's impressed me, but he's looked like he's not just completely overmatched at the NBA level. And frankly, given where he's come from, that's kind of what I expected coming into this season.
Between Harrison and James Ennis, who has outperformed expectations, in my opinion, John Hollinger and the rest of the Memphis front office has done a nice job of identifying talent that was underutilized in other places.
Yeah, and there have certainly been some picks that fairly or unfairly were attributed to John or to Chris Wallace, Jordan Adams being the most salient of those that have not worked out. But I think, and they really have not been able to develop any young talent up until this most recent crop. So it has been a concern, but they at least have some guys who look reasonably promising. Jarrell Martin didn't do much tonight, but I've liked what I've seen from him at times this year too. And JaMychal Green, who actually I think closed the game for them. It was interesting. They did not close with Zach Randolph. Maybe that was part of the thinking of going smaller without Gobert, was that, oh, they're going to bring Randolph in. We'd rather have Green out there, and they needed him to guard Lyles, but the Jazz couldn't score down the end. And Quinn Snyder was asked about it, and he just said Rudy was not playing well, and that's why he didn't come back. Well, Rudy was plus 10 on the night. So I mean, I didn't watch the entire game. He did get into foul trouble, and Quinn was frustrated with his foul trouble in Charlotte as well. That was something that he talked about pregame. So maybe this is trying to be like some lesson teaching or whatever. I hope it's that rather than that he actually didn't think that Rudy was the best option to close this one. But it's going to be something to monitor really throughout this season, because they do have so many other options there as well.
Yeah, they do have other options, but none of them are nearly as good as he is, unless we're going to talk about Favors at the five.
Even then, I think that those two guys together, I probably would, with all the other offensive options that they have now, I probably would rather just go with Gobert at the five rather than Favors. And Gobert, yeah, he didn't have it. Like, he got beat by Zach Randolph off the dribble on a play. He had dumb fouls. Yeah, all true. But also, hey, a guy's not playing well, it's not like they're getting killed in his minutes, as I said. And this is one thing that I always just, I don't see it the same as coaches. It's just, all right, if a guy is playing poorly in one game, that's going to like trump everything that we've seen over the rest of these guys' careers up until now.
Particularly when the matchup is so much better suited to him than anyone else.
All right, I think we're done here. Don't forget, of course, about the Twitter NBA show live at halftime of the national games this coming Wednesday. Future editions, we will probably just pick and choose when there are good national games to do it. But we'll, of course, let you know ahead of time. If you want to hear a little bit more about what the show is going to be, we recorded just a short teaser about it in the RSS feed. So we're going to tweet the link out at that point. You can just watch it straight in your Twitter browser. So we appreciate, of course, all the support that you guys have given us, and we'd love to get this thing off the ground. It's not going to be some amazing production value at first, but they're going to give us a few resources. And if this thing takes off, then we might get more, and maybe we can even do stuff like highlights and stuff like that. But it should be pretty close to the Dunked On treatment. But a lot of people have said, hey, we would love to get your halftime analysis. We'd love to get live analysis right after the game is over, rather than having to wait until the next morning or you know, 3 hours after the game's over when we actually get to post the pod. So we'll see how this goes. And of course, we'd love to get some feedback on Twitter. And we also would love to get some questions for you guys that we can address during both the halftime shows and the postgame shows. If you have Periscope, free app, just download that. If you follow me, you can fix it so you get a notification anytime that we go live. That's another great way to follow it as well. Twitter's going to be promoting it. Hopefully we'll get some new listeners in, and you guys can say that you followed us before we became slightly more famous than we already are, which is not famous at all.
Yeah, it's going to be great. And the idea of taking questions live and having some a little bit prepared is really fun. It's something that I enjoy a lot when we get to do it on the show. And yeah, it's going to be a great experience. Already looking forward to it.
All right, we'll be back tomorrow night here on Dunked On. Probably do another gamer, and then we'll have a couple more interesting, more macro episodes to fill out the week. We'll talk to you all soon. Till then.